Hey, Perf Bites listeners, before you get started on today's episode, we'd like to mention the generous support of our sponsor, Flood.io. Imagine your load test plan runs great with just 10 threads, but now you need 100,000 users. Distributed load testing seems like a good idea, right? But now you're wrestling with out-of-memory errors and blocked RMI ports, and your load generators outnumber the target servers for JMeter. You are throwing knives in the dark with limited feedback and mandrolic reporting. Say hello to Flood.io. Launch Flood Test using JMeter or Gatling, view and share test results in real time, scale out your own grid across the globe in minutes. Flood.io, distributed load testing for everyone.
It's time for Perf Bites.
What the f*** is Perf Bites?
The fourth square meal of the day.
Simple breakfast Perf Bites.
Waffles.
Microwave ready.
Blobbity blah. Blobbity blah.
Add nutritional value to your brain.
It's time for Perf Bites with your hosts Mark Tomlinson and James Pulley.
Perf Bites.
Whatever.
Whatever. Hey, it's time for Perf Bites. James, how are you?
I'm doing pretty good. It's spring.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, hold on. Hooray, hooray. It's almost the 1st of May. Outdoor coding begins today.
Outdoor coding. That sounds good. Yeah. Speaking of coding, our topic today is performance in development, where, of course, James, you and I are going to attempt to help all of those engineers in everyone's organizations who probably know the least about performance and usually help them take a few steps towards getting it right before they deploy their code into any other innocent environment like QA or staging or pre-prod or integration or LT or, God forbid, you just deploy it automatically to production.
No, Mark, that never happens.
It does happen. Actually, I'm going to say right off the bat here, when I was at Test Bash recently, there was a guy that got up on stage, Jez Nicholson, who got up on stage in front of everyone and said, "Hi, everyone, and I'm a developer." Actually, he's a developer manager, like 20 years worth of managing developers and all sorts of different stuff. But that guy, Jez, actually had the cojones to get up in front of a testing crowd, a rabid testing crowd at Test Bash, and actually talk about how to win developers as your friends and influence business people, which is kind of our topic today, which is helping our best friends, our closest friends in application development, the developers, actually start getting performance right. Even if their business people don't really know what they're doing about performance, the developers could be the first line of defense.
That's true, Mark. And unlike when you have a dedicated performance testing team doing all the performance tests and you're using food as a bribery mechanism to cultivate good relations with other groups, now you're going to have developers actually engaging in performance behavior. So that relationship has to be on more of a technical basis than a
gastronomic one, especially if they're getting certain special forms of chocolate.
Right? Yes, we will not go into that one.
Yeah, no, that's a shout out to Pitar.
Yeah,
it was very funny. No, really. So let's be really clear before we go too much further on this topic. James, you and I are both ex-Microsoft employees, and so you couldn't really survive at Microsoft without having developer skills. And they complemented almost every other role. You'd find business analysts or PMs, program managers, group program managers, heck, people all the way up to senior management had done their time in some way, shape, or form doing coding just so that they understood technologically what was happening. Now, when we talk about performance in a development aspect, we're talking about developers doing performance testing. And that means more than just doing the test. It could mean a lot of different things about when I say, James, performance, developers doing performance, that could mean a lot of different things. What are the first ones that come off the top of your head?
Well, Mark, you're citing Microsoft as a really good example because philosophically, Microsoft really doesn't believe in QA as a separate practice. It is a function of developers or a group of developers maybe who have been penalized for some reason and they have to work exclusively in QA for a while until they cultivate favor again. But fundamentally, they do not believe in QA as a role. So you have testers engaging in performance activities?
Well, it's sort of saying, you know, what are the top things that we think about? Some people might think, okay, you're doing performance testing and development. You must be talking about the environment. How do I test at a lower scale environment or the chaotic small environment? And that's one very, it's such a common question and a common mistake or an area of ambiguity that you might think that's what we're talking about. And it's not that we're not talking about that, but it's true. If you're trying to do performance work in development, you're usually testing at a much, much smaller scale, and that can be incredibly challenging. But what about thinking about it, James? What about like thinking of development as the schedule of the process? Let's say somebody's still in the waterfall era, or even maybe slightly scrummer fallish, agile-ish, fallish, whatever. But if they're still waterfall, there's sort of a development phase where normally, instead of waiting till the end, people start shifting left. Like we tell people, shift performance left while things are still being developed.
Right. So you have this either short waterfall where you're doing iterative development, and so you're doing iterative performance testing as stuff gets kind of popped off the stack.
Yeah.
Or you're involved in agile where if we look at agile as a definition, you should have testers right there with the developers who are working on test cases as code is being written.
Yeah.
And typically it's more developers working as the testers in that case rather than traditional QA. So how do we get that knowledge set down to the actual developer so they can build effective performance tests?
Yeah, exactly. Another thing you might think about is just developers as performance testers. And are they doing performance engineering or performance testing? I got into a real debate with a developer at one point who said, you know, there's some mantra from years ago, thou shalt not prematurely optimize. It was very Yoda-like. Optimize prematurely, I forget it. I can't get my Yoda down. It's not working right.
Oh, maybe there's a pill for that, you know.
There might be.
Premature optimization.
Premature optimization. Sometimes there's a confusion between being as a developer, because if you actually are changing how you're going to write the code based on understanding performance, you might get into engineering the solution at the same time. So are you being a performance engineer? Are you being a performance tester? And hey, do you even care what your title is? If you're a developer primarily and you're doing something about performance, whether you're validating it or optimizing it or whatever, what are you doing? So that can be a debate as well. Some people want some clarity. When James and I are talking, typically we're talking about a developer who needs to do both. They need to think about performance before they write some code, and they need to some extent, validate that they didn't screw it up before they check in the code. And that involves sort of performance engineering and performance checking. Now, last one, James, you brought up, which was pretty good, is just this whole organizational perspective on performance in development.
Yeah, and here's where we have kind of a perverse set of checks and balances occurring, where performance testing, either in the form of the developer or in the form of a separate organizational structure, is reporting to the development manager. Ultimately, QA you would think of as a separate organization, as checks and balances in the process. If there is a defect, we can report it, and it gets tracked, it gets fixed, it comes back, we recheck it again, and it goes out the door. Well, this type of structural problem occurs in many organizations where QA is reporting to the development manager. The development manager may not understand your role. They're probably a former developer, and they may just look at you as a nuisance.
Yeah,
because all you do is slow their code down to production.
Well, and what's really interesting is the people I've seen that get promoted. Let's say you were a really successful development manager or a lead in development. You had a totally successful project. And what else are you going to do with successful IT people, no matter where they come from? You promote them. So then you promote that guy and promote that guy, and he or she, maybe their background is development, and they're in their thinking, I wrote the code, therefore I am entitled to 100% of their success. It's not that maybe they didn't even do performance testing. They just got lucky. And that's a dangerous equation. So there's an organizational perspective of performance kind of falling under development. But in all of these cases, whether you're talking about the environment, and getting performance in a lower scale environment, if you're talking about the phase of testing and testing earlier in the life cycle in a dev phase, if you're talking about being a performance tester, being a performance engineer and wearing multiple hats, or if you're talking about a development manager who now has performance reporting underneath them, all four of those different perspectives are actually a challenge to the normal way a developer works. We often think about the logic first and the temporal or performance qualities second. It, particularly, James, I'll say, for new developers that are coming out of school, they have even less worldly training and experience. They have really, really perfunctory, straightforward computer science, programming skills, maybe data skills, and that's about it.
And Mark, I hate to say it, but as a computer science graduate, CS graduates are horrible testers.
CS graduates are usually terrible testers. Not any offense to them, but they don't give you any training.
That's right. You want the physics graduate who knows how to program, who's not missing a limb from a pendulum accident.
That's gruesome. Horrible. Like we put razor blades on a pendulum and then take the arm right off. That could be bad. Actually, they need to understand the Bernoulli principle. They should understand the first law of thermodynamics. They should Little's law. You should understand the Little's law if you've never calculated a utilization law. I mean, these are all good things to come out of your technical training for a computer science degree. So that kind of sets the stage. We're actually talking about kind of all four of those things. But how did we get to a point, James? Now, when I started, quality was still a fairly separate segment. Granted, it was not just waterfall, but I mean, there was this belief that the checking function was totally isolated and separated from the development function, which goes back in by probably 50, 60 years. It goes way, way back, right? IBM, and maybe for financial reasons, we did this as well. We had quality as a quality control separate from the development organization. They're very
separate. Plus, for their larger systems early on, telephone switches, medical systems, there were a lot of critical tests that had to be done in order to prevent catastrophic failure. So testers had a very important role in that case. But getting back to the question of how did we get here, well, I think let's start with the most common one out there. Your company is a startup with every engineer wearing multiple hats, including a set of Google glasses, and your developer and your founder is a developer.
Yes. Speaking of wearing multiple hats, Dan Downing did that great session at STPCon about wearing multiple hats of performance, which was really, really great. So this one, and especially with any trendy, you know, I want to be hip and cool and hot, and if I'm going to learn a new skill or a new way to do something in my career, for newcomers to this, you know, not every company is a startup. And, you know, you have to be a really kick-ass engineer to actually get into a startup. You have to be able to do all these other things. But for the overwhelming majority of people that are working, I hate to say it, work-a-day, everyday jobs in a company, in IT, not every company is a startup. They don't all have shareholders. They don't have, you know, huge operational goals. They don't have efficiency goals, quality standards. They don't have existing install base and existing service usage across hundreds or if not thousands or even millions of users. If your company is a startup, it's just, I heard this phrase recently, full stack developer. Well, a full stack developer in a startup is like a super, super developer compared to everyone else. Like they don't teach you how to be that guru level person in college. There's also some dysfunction that leads to the fact that testing ends up or performance testing ends up in development. And that is your testing organization failed you somehow. So, and you failed you and you probably fired them or got rid of them because I didn't understand the value of testing.
Yeah, I mean, there are for a couple of very, very solid reasons here. And when we see this happening quite often is legitimate failure. Quite frankly, they just sucked. Either you hired the wrong people or you had them in the wrong role. It came down to, well, I can cut developers or I can cut testers. Oh, I'm going to cut testers. Yep. You know, so you cut your costs and saved your budget. It's interesting to see if you wind up having to pay that cost later in terms of lost sales and things of that nature. That's a separate discussion.
Yep.
Or here's what's happening more often. Quite frankly, you fired your QA outsourcer because they were delivering such low value. Here's that whole situation of hiring people right out of college, not training them, putting them right into a role, and expecting them to learn. And then the value is so low that the company gets fired.
Yeah. This is mostly, you and James and I agree, this is completely unfair, usually to the practitioner, because they're being set up by their management.
Absolutely.
You know, I find there's, you know, this whole cutting corners on quality. If you cut corners on talent, well, eventually you're going to outsource to the point where you're like, well, gee, we can't even find a good QA outsourcer anymore because they're all, you know, low value. So let's just have development do testing. In fact, they keep talking about this DevOps cool stuff. Let's just have them do it.
Yeah. And Mark, I want to go back to something you said right at the very beginning. It's not the practitioner's fault. It is the manager's fault. And I know this is something both you and I get hit with quite often online, mm-hmm. when we say, hey, you don't have the skills to do the job. The practitioner says, hey, stop picking on me, that type of thing.
Yeah.
It's not their fault.
Yeah. Now, another reason we ended up having this, we already talked about it a little bit, where the executive leadership came from development. Again, they got promoted there somehow. And they think developers pretty much rule the planet.
Exactly.
And they maybe they have their buddy George, who George was the super developer who, you know, has 25 years experience back in the 90s. And the CEO, you know, anything that happens on the new product, well, that guy kind of has a back channel, talks to George and says, can you tell me the truth about X, Y, and Z?
And they feel like if they properly incentivize the developers, that will have a beneficial impact on quality.
Yeah, it will not. And, you know, those mentalities in development, there's little quirks, and there's some of the people with the worst people skills on the planet work in development. And at the same time, you're really lucky if you find a great close-knit team of people who do communicate well and do like one another and don't just want to be left alone. Because it is incredibly challenging work from a concentration standpoint. But there are some people who, like George, who doesn't wear shoes and doesn't bathe and has a corner office and is buddies with the CEO. And at any given point, George can overrule you as a developer because you don't know what you're doing. Though George doesn't have a background as really doing performance very well. So there can be some real biases even that go to your executive leadership as to who should really be the primary person on performance. I don't think there's any one primary person in performance except for the customer and actually the corner office. They should know how many users, how fast, what do we need to deliver, what's our competitive time frame, what's the M&A, what's the scalability of the business. All of that translates into performance at the end of the day. In the last point, I think how we got here brings me to the DevOps comment, which we kind of said before. If you're a developer and you have to know about operations, you're doing a lot of automation. And the more developers actually spend time learning about real operations, the real world, they start encountering things like volume and scalability and real performance problems, because that's where their little code from their laptop is finally running on the cloud times a million. And they will have a crash course in performance. Actually, the most dangerous time to have a developer learning about performance is when they're thrown into ops on a firefight, because they'll do something like, well, can't you just core the server and give me a thread dump in the middle of what's happening? You know, who cares about those end user sessions? Let's just dump them. They'll just fail over. They won't get any errors.
Or have you heard this one? Can't you just get more hardware?
Yeah, well, we have the cloud. Isn't it elastic? Oh, gosh. I do know of two customers that have had the runaway elasticity. So it was more elastic and more elastic and more elastic and more elastic. It hit the memory thresholds and spin up another AMI. Hit the memory threshold, hit another AMI. And the more memory threshold, the more CPU got chewed up because it's going through garbage collection as the heap got bigger and bigger. They ended up with thousands of AMIs, and it cost them a crap load.
Mark, this is absolutely proof that bad code will scale to fill the available resource pool no matter the size of the pool.
Or if it's elastic, it will just keep growing like the blob. It will just take over, right? We'll take a little break here, James, before we get into really giving some hardcore tips to development and development managers that are working with performance.
Hosting for perfbytes.com has been provided by NewCo, New Centers of Excellence in Performance Engineering, PowerTest Professional Services, The Script Farm, LoadRunner by the Hour, Videra Tech, Cloud Architect, and no load test. For more information, go to www.newco.com or call 703-856-8187.
Excellent. Now, you and I came up with some rambling tips here, but we've organized them pretty well. And as usual, it's a zero-based index, so the array is zero-based. You want to kick us off with the first one?
Absolutely. Tip zero, performance requires that you measure something. You can't just run it and look at it and say, hey, it looks good. You've actually got to measure something and be consistent about it. And here's some good recommendations. Response time, volume, or some sort of resource which might be impinged.
Yeah. So if you're running one thread once through, that's a sample size of one. And that's not a good sample size for statistics. Even in development, you can do the same thing 100 times. And does it take the same amount of time? What's your average response time just on a transaction for one user? Because as you say, James, as a mantra, if it doesn't scale for one, it will never scale for many.
True.
Which is kind of crazy because scalability of one is one.
Well, that's better than zero. You know, the one divided by zero of the uncertainty.
Right. If you try to run one and it doesn't run, that's a scalability of zero. So that would be, that would be good. Okay. So to go with tip zero, right off the bat, James, I called you on trick. Because tips and tricks, there should always be like trick or treat. There's tips and tricks.
Yeah.
So what's trick zero that goes with
trick,
that?
Trick zero. Always assume you will run in a resource sparse environment. So if you have a super developer workstation with a huge amount of RAM and CPU, and it would look like a server in any other organization, and it runs really fast on your computer, and it runs really fast in all the tests, try going to a Raspberry Pi.
Try looking for something that has much less, or in the mobile world. Right. So if you let's say you're developing for your mobile device, which is a brand new iPhone 5, super fast, or an iPad 4, you turn around and your average customer in the real world is running on an iPhone 4 or, you know, smaller, less, not multiple processor, single processor, less memory, whatever. Don't assume that if it runs fine for you from a performance standpoint, that it doesn't take twice as long to load your app or use your app on a lesser mobile device. So I think James's good trick is you can trick your developers into, hey, if you guys can get it to perform well on this crappy little machine, then when it actually goes out into the real world where people have more faster processors and more memory or more network bandwidth, it's going to run great. But it's kind of a trick.
Exactly. That's the whole point of get it to run in a very ugly, ugly, dirty environment. And if it runs well and scales well there, then the odds of it scaling in a cleaner environment are much better. They're not guaranteed, but they're much better.
The odds are, on the whole, they'll be much better, except the inverse is true in the cloud. So if you're developing on your desktop and it runs really well with one thread on your little desktop, but you're deploying automatically into an elastic cloud environment where you have thousands of transactions concurrently, if you never do the inverse, that's what good load testing is for. That's why people do the testing in production, where they have a dev or test environment in the cloud so you can actually do that. As a developer, your desktop, your dev environment is very different than production. I'll throw tip number one, which is actually something you had brought up, but I love this as well, which is, as a developer, usually you're developing to a spec, some requirement of some sort, and we try to put it in a form that's discrete so you can code against it from an engineering perspective. So if you test to the spec, don't test it as it was built. So if you took some liberties or misinterpretations of what the spec is, and then you built something, and then you test to what you built, it's not the same as making sure you met the requirement, which brings me to another interpretation of this. Make sure your user stories actually have performance requirements on them.
And if they don't, ask.
Yeah, ask. Exactly.
Just stop right there and just say, what is the performance component of this user story? Otherwise, you as a developer are going to make some assumptions which are guaranteed to be distinct and different from the architecture group and from the ops group, and from platform and functional test and everyone else.
Right. Tip number two is you can ask a performance tester, how should I performance test this? If you have a performance testing team, if you're not the only person doing it, you can also, let's just say you want to have a conversation about how many users are going to actually hit this component at the API level. How many transactions per second do I need to support? What's the response time goal for an SLA? Those three things alone, the business should know about it. They know how many target market, what customers are going to hit the campaign. They know if they have a legal requirement somewhere in there. If they don't, ask. So tip number two is if you don't have requirements, you may have to go facilitate building them as a developer. Ask. That'll be a good one. James, what about tip three?
Tip number three, I like to call the dragnet tip. Mark, if you may recall Joe Friday, when he would be interviewing crime victims, he would ask for the who, what, when, where, how, why.
Just the facts, ma'am.
Exactly. Just the facts, ma'am. And so in this case, we want the developer to have a very clear understanding of what they're testing, why they're testing it, how they're testing it, when they're testing it. You see a trend here. So having a clear understanding of, you know, for the dragnet principle of who, what, when, where, why, how, and, you know, were they wearing, you know, a red jacket or something, will help you as a developer build an effective performance test.
Yeah, on the fly, just asking the how question. How is this going to be used? How will it be called? How will it be? How will it respond? Well, it'll respond in n number of seconds with n number of bytes of data returned to the end user or to the client. That's how is the greatest question. I think that's a great place to start. Which brings me to tip number four. If you don't even know the answer to how, just run 10 threads of your unit test. And if you can, vary the data. Like if you have, create 10 unique users and have different users hit the same row, hit the same transaction. Just that alone, James, I've seen customers, developer teams that just, their eyes just open up. Like, look, we're writing a unit test to run one thread already and it hits this thing, pass, fail, done. It's like a functional test. You tell them to run 10 threads, all of a sudden the conversations just start going, wow, this thing really blew up, or it pegged the CPU, or it's still running on a runaway process, or it didn't even run the second thread. You know, all these crazy things.
Total lockout.
Yeah. So it can be a real eye-opener. Even if you don't have good support from your business folks or you don't have a performance team to help you, just say, you know what, our default setting for running unit tests is we run one thread, and then we run 10 threads on our nightly build. Done. And at least we get some ideas and then trend it over time. Go listen to our episode on continuous performance testing. We talk about nightly builds and trending. That'd be really good. James, what about our last tip, the tip number five? I love this one.
Tip number five. This is something that impacts just about every developer at one time or another, and actually immature performance testers. Every code has a hockey stick in the efficiency curve. So it scales linearly to a point, and then you hit the knee in the curve, and it scales logarithmically.
Well, that's easy for you to say.
So response time, you know, goes from a nice linear curve to a logarithmic curve, and resource utilization goes through the roof as well on one or more of the impinged resources. So never assume scalability. Linear scalability or infinite scalability. That's a career deadly assumption.
Yes.
Mark, I'm sure that customer that you were looking at that had thousands of AMI spun up, whatever that developer cost in terms of salary, the cost to run all those AMIs 24/7 until they figured that out, I'm sure dwarfed the compensation of the developer who made the decisions that led to that.
Yeah, I mean, that of course it was a no-brainer. Total cost
and
ownership.
And Mark, for the bonus trick, I do we call this the barber trick?
Well, it relates back to tip number one, which is about user stories again and having your specs. Or as mentioning barber, we have to say go back and listen to his perf rant on the performance requirements episode because he was talking about desirements instead of requirements. But he also told me this story once, which we'll bring up as a trick. We'll call it trick number six, which is to write the performance requirements on the back of the Kanban cards and stick them back up on the wall. And then you know what happens, James, when the Kanban card eventually falls on the floor?
When they pick it up, they're going to look at the back of the card and the front.
And they're going to say, what the hell is this? Number of users, number of seconds of response time, SLA, number of concurrent transactions per second, total number of maximum number of connections, whatever the performance, volume time, maximum 4 gig heap, maximum 128 connection object, whatever it is. They put it on the back, and then all of a sudden they all start freaking out and pulling their cards off the Kanban. So if you're in the development world, in the agile world, and you're doing Kanban, boy, if you don't have the performance requirements already in your user story, put them on the back of the card, and then, you know, eventually someone will start screaming about it.
And if they're totally ignoring you as a performance resource, just go ahead and write them, and I'll pop yourself a bag of popcorn and get a soft drink and just park yourself in the cube opposite the Kanban board and wait.
Just wait. Watch. Hey, do you guys ever look on the back of those cards? Yeah, awesome.
It's time for a perf rant.
So before you start your next test effort, I'm going to rant with you on the secret of test estimation, and I'm not talking about the estimate goat. Now, there's a lot of people out there that will tell you it's all about front-end optimization and that time to first byte doesn't really matter. And they're usually referring to things like reducing the number of HTTP requests, setting expires headers, reducing number of DOM elements, and making sure assets are minimized, optimized, customized, economized, immunocompromised, legitimized, and lobotomized accordingly. But before you get out your YSLOW or page speed or buckets of real user monitoring data from the other side of the globe, open Chrome, open the developer tools, and then open the network panel. Now go to the page of the site that matters the most, and normally the one that makes you revenue. Open it. And did that just take 12 seconds? Then yes, you probably need to performance test. But seriously, have a look at the first document in the waterfall chart. It's normally the first document that gets a HTTP 200. Add up all of the time up to including the waiting block for that resource. And the page I'm looking at says 6.69 seconds. Now divide that by the page load time at the bottom of the screen, and mine says 8.32 seconds. So you've just figured out the proportions for your next test effort. For this site I'm looking at, 80% of my time will be figuring out what happened to that first byte, and I'm tipping the database. And 20% of my time will be tweaking YSLOW scores along with some suitable JSON CSS profiling to boot. Front-end optimization is cool, but your site will still suck if your time to first or last byte is still slow.
Great perf rant from Tim Koopmans. If you didn't recognize his voice, there's Tim Koopmans gives us a perf rant on web performance optimization on the front end. But so as we wrap up, James, what any last thoughts or tips from your side?
I would say this tip applies to developers and new performance testers who are engaging in performance activities. Expect failure and learn from it. The reason why Mark and I are at the level we're at primarily is because we've been exposed to a lot of different projects. And we've had an opportunity, quite frankly, to fail in any number of tasks and recover from them and learn from those mistakes. You should expect during your first 6 months of performance activities, you're going to fail a lot. You're going to miss things. But use it as an opportunity to go back and look at what actually happened and find where you failed. It can either be in process. It can be in deployment. It can be in the assumptions that you made. But find where those things are failing, and you won't make the mistake the next time. But be willing to admit to that mistake.
I think performance testing also, if you do it in very short sessions. In development, we're talking about taking half a day to run a small load test or a small, just those 10-thread kinds of tests. Single user performance analysis, great. You're thinking about response times and loading times and starting to think about the end user experience. Run 10 threads. Hey, that didn't work very well. What did we learn from that? So yeah, if you're on small scale in development, it's the perfect place to fail. That's where we expect you to fail.
And keep in mind for developers, if you can't repeat a test, it's not a test.
Yeah, do it twice. That's another good thing. That's a good tip number seven is if you can run the same thing twice and you get the same expected output, yeah, then that's a good consistent kind of a test. If you can't do it twice in a row, something else weird is going on. And it might be that George right next to you is running a build on the server or doing an FTP or clearing out logs in the middle of your sample run. And then you're like, gosh, it would be nice if I had my own test lab instead of these darn development systems. And you're on your way to building a performance center of excellence and ruling the world as a performance god. Exactly. That's exactly right. James, that brings us to the end of episode 42.
It's the answer to life, the universe, and everything, which is ironic given that we're talking about developers engaging in performance tests.
Yes, because they sometimes think the answer might be 42, but it's not. Go back and re-listen to this episode. And of course, anyway, Perf Bytes listeners, in reality, you've come to the close of another developer mentally unchallenged episode of Perf Bytes. I think I said that right. As always, we'd like to thank each of you sincerely for taking the time to listen to the show today.
And as always, I'd like to thank my mother for tuning in and listening.
Of course, I will also extend my thanks to the sexy Irish voice of Perf Bytes, Dr. Martha, who is actually making dinner for me in the next room. I think we're having turkey burgers or something like that. Probably some guacamole. Who knows? And of course, James and I would like to give a special thanks to our sponsors, Flood.io and Cubic Loadpack, for their continued sponsorship and support of the Perf Bytes show. And of course, to the Perf Bytes community for all the learning and great things that we provide you.
And Mark, today's episode is powered by the TARDIS. Any show which has episodes named Voyage of the Damned and 42 is my type of show.
Awesome. And of course, and remember that all of the content of the Perf Bytes is copyrighted and protected by the same technology that is present in the TPM chip on your laptop, which is the Total Protection Encryption. So when we broadcast this podcast and then it ends up on your machine, it actually is going to get encrypted on your disk, whether you knew it or not. And no, actually, it's just a copyright. So be nice and don't steal our stuff, right?
For more information about Perf Bytes, visit the show's website, www.perfbytes.com, or follow us on the Twitter and the Facebook. And of course, you can always subscribe and listen to the Perf Bytes podcast on iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio. Just open up your favorite listening app and search for Perf Bytes, click the subscribe button and favorites button or whatever else you have.
Some kind of a button. Just click on the button and it'll work. Yes. Keep in mind that the Perf Bytes show and staff are supporters of the Practical Performance Analyst, the Performance Engineering Book of Knowledge, the Computer Measurement Group, the Workshop on Performance and Reliability, and of course, the Software Test Professionals Community of Software Testers. We hope to see you at the next STPCon, of course. That'll be in November in Denver, so you get a lot of time. Actually, Call for Proposals is open if you guys want to put a paper in. We're looking for new and exciting things about continuous performance, mobile performance, cloud performance, performance, developer performance, not dancing, no performance dancing. I don't think we're looking for that. Or a chemical performance, like if you're a meth chemical chemist, we don't do that kind of thing.
And of course, don't forget about the Perf Bytes annual meetup in Monroe, North Carolina this coming July 4th. At my place, we'll be doing a little bit of pig. And if you want chicken, be sure and indicate that on your RSVP.
Yes, and the RSVP actually goes just via email to, you can send it to info@perfbytes.com or james.pulley@perfbytes.com. That'll get you there too, right, James?
Exactly.
And you're going to be in HP Discover in June with Wilson Marr.
That's the current plan. I was going to have a presentation, but I think I'm just going to be hanging out and meeting the peeps.
So meet up with James in Las Vegas in June. I'm kind of on a hiatus, you know, working and vacating, but I will be at the Pig Roast in July. I also have some online training via STP with Intro to Performance and Performance Analysis. So look under the training schedule on STP for more information. Thank you guys for listening to Perf Bytes. We'll see you on the next episode.
Have a great week.